related.
Okay, so you take that money then for financial aid.
Yes.
Okay.
I would just second the financial aid idea. I've benefited from it at Wisconsin Lutheran, and it's great to have.
Okay. Pastor?
Financial aid is great. I think that it would also be great to invest in more technology resources for the students.
Okay. Sarah?
I can't contradict what anyone has said. Obviously, it costs money to send your children to a non-public school. Okay. And my husband and I have made tremendous financial sacrifice to do that. I would do it again. I feel like I could be the MasterCard commercial. It's priceless.
Okay. To our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with several representatives then from Christ Lutheran Academy here in Kenosha. Pastor Remke, Greta Martin, a teacher there, Andrew Billings, a former student there, and Sarah Billings, a person who has been involved and actively involved in forming the school. You've helped our listeners understand the place of private parochial education in our society today and the challenges facing private parochial education. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. You're listening to Community Matters, a discussion of important issues facing our communities. The program is co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Troy McDonald, a Gateway marketing student who also serves as a development specialist for WGTD. Now, here's today's host.
Be still and God say that's go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Be still and God say that's go! Hey!
Chants like that have been heard all across the country. Today, Sergeant John DeMario from the Tavern Squad in Kenosha and Chief of Police of Kenosha, John Morrissey, speak at length about the cases in Ferguson, New York, and Milwaukee. Is it a race issue? What do they think? And what would they do if they were faced with a similar situation? All that and so much more. We talk about recent instances at local bars that have raised a tremendous amount of concern by citizens. So we're talking about it all right now. All right, we want to welcome here to Community Matters. Please welcome Sergeant John DeMario and the Chief of Police for Kenosha, John Morrissey. Thank you both for being here.
We appreciate the offer.
So, Chief Morrissey, we'll start with you. You know, with the incident in Ferguson, Missouri, and other places receiving so much attention, a part of the population feel like they are not represented by the police force. And the Kenosha News released some statistics earlier in November, early December. 92% of the force is white, and 7.3% are minority. That's what was reported. And people now seem to have more disdain than ever. Is the Kenosha Police Department racist?
Absolutely not. But let's clarify those numbers that you're talking about. Those numbers were reported from 2007, and I'm not sure why that's the numbers they used, and we had that discussion. So those numbers are inaccurate to begin with, but since 2008, which is the year that I took over as chief, there's been a push to certainly diversify the department. And again, I know that the question you ask is more race-based. But I think we need to look at it in a different context. Diversity is a lot more than race. Diversity covers a lot of other things, religion, sexual orientation, all those kinds of things. So I don't think it's fair to me, my department, or any other police department, for that matter, to simply refer to something in the context of race. So the department is much more diversified than those numbers would indicate. It certainly is still a predominantly white department. But the department certainly isn't racist, and I would tell you that I'm not aware of any racist officer that we have in the department.
The Kenosha Police Department, you know, of course, you've reached out to minorities in a lot of great ways. You've teamed up with the Boys and Girls Club. So do you constantly look at ways to reach out to those different groups?
I do. we're in a recruitment process, actually just closed, but I saw the numbers now. This is the highest number of individuals that are minimally qualified to apply. We have 918 individuals that applied. I'll have 9 positions, but it's the largest group of African-American females that have ever applied, and I believe that's 21. We have 52 African-American males that applied, so we're seeing a lot more applications. Now, there's a lot more to the process than just simply applying. You know, it's the written test, who shows up, and then the oral interview and that kind of stuff. So we're working in that and reaching out through the NAACP, through the Boys and Girls Club, through the schools, through the colleges, Gateway, and all the rest of them to try and do a recruitment in the minority community. But I will answer any question that ever deals with who I hire as. The person that gets hired is going to be qualified for that position. I will not. I don't think it's fair to the department, fair to the officers, or fair to the community to simply fill a position based on minority. If everything is equal, then you use those other factors to fill those positions, and I think that's a good thing. We have a very, what I would consider, a very diverse department now. You know, we have our first openly gay males. You worry about issues there. We haven't had one issue that I'm aware of because of that. We have a couple of Asian guys now, one named Singh and Vang, and they fit in well. And that diversity that they bring, along with, you know, the African-Americans, the Hispanics, and everybody else, makes us a much stronger and better department for many reasons. And I think it's when you look at community issues, it's easier to turn to some of those individuals and say, why is this an issue? Why, you know, was this taken wrong? You know, and over my career, I certainly have said things that aren't meant to be out of context, but, you know, after they're said, you're like, well, that certainly could have been taken wrong. But as long as you clarify that, but so the diversity, I think, in the department's a great thing. We have a lot of females as well. All of that plays into it, but I'm going to say again, those who get hired are qualified or otherwise they wouldn't be hired.
Mm-hmm. Period. Regardless Period. Of.
You know, right. If I have 10 positions open and the 10 qualified individuals are white males, then that's who's going to be offered the position. We've done a much better job. I don't anticipate that. I haven't seen that. You know, we're doing promotions here next week, police and fire. There's a female that'll be a sergeant, that kind of thing. So there is diversity in the ranks. You know, supervision, we do have an issue with diversity, but it's not so much on my end. The minority population doesn't want to put in for it, and there's many reasons for that. Mm-hmm. You know, you've worked and you make it to day shift, and all of a sudden the chief says, hey, do you want to be a sergeant? But you're going to third shift, and now you're going to work your way back up through. Or more importantly, you're going to lose a significant amount of overtime. So there's a lot of choices that go into that. I think in the next upcoming promotional process, we'll have a lot more minorities that put in for it. But I, as a chief, am very concerned about the first black man or woman that becomes a supervisor, because they're going to be featured and it's going to be said, you know, Kenosha PD has its first African-American supervisor.
And do you think they'll be held to a higher standard or a different standard,
I think,
a microscope
right.
on them?
Yeah, I think unfortunately they're held to, or they're going to be simply said they got that because of their skin color, which isn't true. They're not going to get that if they're not qualified either. And I think that they think about that. They don't want to be drugged through the media. They don't want to be, well, you know, they have to make a decision. Sergeant DiMario, I'm hoping, makes his decisions on the policies, procedures, and the laws. I don't care what color he is. That sergeant's going to have to do it as well. And I really think, unfortunately, you know, and it's happened when we've hired our first black female, you know, the paper, the media makes it an issue. Well, it shouldn't be an issue. And in order to go back to Ferguson, and I might be in the minority on this, but if I was to talk to the President of the United States, I want him to answer one question for me.
Barack Obama, the president. Yeah.
Barack Obama, the president. If I can have one conversation with him, answer this question to me. Does it matter, Mr. President, what color the officer was? Because if it does, then we have a much bigger problem in this country. It shouldn't matter whether the officer was white, the officer was black, whatever color the victim was, or suspect, whatever you want to call. It has to be, is this or was this a legally justifiable shooting? And that's how it has to be looked at. At least that's my belief as a chief. You have to look at them as colorblind, because if somebody says it would have been okay for a black officer to shoot Michael Brown, this country has a much bigger problem than I believe is there.
Hmm. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, of course, the issue in Ferguson, but there is also the issue with Eric Garner in New York, where the training of these officers have come into question. How does the Kenosha Police Force go about training its force and the holds and things that are legal and not legal? What's that process like for a new officer coming through?
Well, as you know, Gateway here has the police academy. That's where we send all of our new recruits. So it starts in the police academy, and that curriculum is set throughout the state of whatever the training is, and it's called DAT, Defense and Arrest Tactics. So there's holds, there's training, there's knee strikes, there's batons, there's tasers, there's all kinds of use of force and the levels to do it. And there's always a misperception that, you know, if somebody pulls a knife, we need to pull a knife. It's not that way. It's you're always one step above. So, you know, you could try empty hand controls, which is talking. You could try strong arm control where I, you know, grab your arm and try. But it doesn't mean that I have to start there. I need to be one step above whoever they're with. That's the training they get. I'm not extremely familiar with the New York case. I certainly know about the chokehold and that, but I didn't follow it enough to really comment on that. But every officer is trained in the academy initially, and then we have in-service every year. The DAT, I mean, they're trained on handcuffing techniques. Well, they're trained in a sterile environment that you put your hands, you know, so if me and John are the two there, we work together. He's going to put his hands behind his back, and we're going to handcuff him. And well, that's pretty easy if the subject's compliant. It's when the person's not compliant that we have the issues, and that's, of course, what gets videotaped and critiqued. But I think there's been a lot of progress. I serve on the Curriculum Advisory Committee for the Law Enforcement Standard Board Training Division, and we're the committee right underneath the Board of Directors. And we just approved the Law Enforcement Academy will be going up to 720 hours from 520. So there's going to be a lot more training. We're trying to get that training into the new officers on the front end. So there's constant training. There's training, again, in service. There's academy training. There's a lot of specialized training that we send it to. We're going to have supervisors that are DAT instructors. So how that helps me is, if there is a use of force issue, then they can review it and say, no, this is how they're trained or not trained. You may recall several months ago we had a video that made the news of a tasing. And internally and externally I sent that out, and everybody said it was by the book. So, you know, there's individuals that don't believe it. There's nothing I can do about that.
If an officer comes to you, like a Derek Wilson, or an officer who is who dealt with Eric Garner, and they said, "Chief, I had to shoot. This is what I had to do." What goes through your mind?
My mind is a chief.
Yes.
Well, first off, whether it's a shoot situation or anything else, is the health and wellness of that officer needs to be taken care of immediately. That's the first thing, is you have to do it. In any case of a possible policy violation or anything like that, it may seem that some chiefs aren't addressing those issues, but I would say that at my level, I don't look at those issues yet. That's what an investigation is for. So currently for the Kenosha PD, depending on the severity of the complaint, it starts at the shift level. So, you know, Sergeant DiMario may be assigned to do the initial investigation. His captain will review it. It goes up to the inspector, the deputy chief, and then to my desk if need be. So the first thing you can't do is jump to a conclusion of that the officer was 100% right or 100% wrong. It takes that investigation. Now, I do think there's issues that I would have handled different as the chief in Ferguson, but that's, again, I'm not there. I didn't see it. But I think you have to balance that whole department, community, and the individual there. So it's a certainly nothing that the chief ever wants to deal with, but whether it's a shooting or any complaint for all that matter, you know, we're very, very fortunate. We have very few complaints of that. The majority of the complaints we get are that officers are rude, and the majority of those turn out to be, it may come across as rude, but, you know, it's, you're getting a ticket and you just don't like it, and the officer sounded rude. But
we're going to incorporate your social media comments as well. So thank you for sending them in. This comment is from Noble Droop Ali, who posted on Facebook. I think the real story is how soft and scared the Kenosha police are. It's pretty obvious that they ride around town all day in fear of minorities. Shaking my head. So I want to actually kind of twist this around. With all of this coverage, is there a sense of where you're going to be hesitating a little bit more when you're dealing with these issues, because now there's more attention on police forces across the country?
I can tell you that as a chief, personally, but as a chief speaking for chiefs in the state, and we've met on this, there is a big concern by chiefs that the officers will now not react quick enough, and they're going to get hurt because of the media attention. They're not going to follow their training. I hope we don't have that problem here. Certainly the job of the shift supervisors, such as Sergeant DiMario and the captains and the lieutenants, are to make sure of that. But there is that concern that, and nobody wants to be drugged through the paper, the media, or anything else. And it's very tough, and especially for younger officers who haven't experienced it. You know, when you get to my level, you become a little more callous to it because my name's drugged through the paper constantly. But for a young officer, that is a traumatic thing for them. I hope it doesn't happen, but it is an absolute valid concern. Reference your comment. I think that's, I'm going to just simply say, an asinine comment. I don't think that the department or the officers are afraid of the minority community. I think they work well with the minority community. So, again, certainly that individual can have his opinion, but I think it's...
Mm-hmm. And we have comments from all across the spectrum as well.
Sure.
As a result of, you know, these incidents, there's been a lot of, you know, how do we solve this problem? And one of the big things coming up is putting cameras on the shirts or, you know, on the attire of the police officer. Could that happen in Kenosha?
It could happen. I think it will happen eventually. I think it currently is a bad idea, and not for the fact that you're going to have cameras, but again, cameras only capture the one view of the camera, and we've seen that in many other things. There's things that happen elsewhere. I'm very concerned about the privacy issues at this point in time of what is going to be allowed, what's not going to be allowed. It's very well established through the courts that if you're in the public eye, then it's there. But we have a lot of issues in hospitals, for example. We have a lot of issues in schools. So is the court going to say, after we spend $750,000 of the city's taxpayers' money, that, sorry, you can't record in a hospital, sorry, you can't record in a school, or you can't record in a church, or more importantly, you can't record in the privacy of a home? The courts have been very consistent for years that the privacy of your home is about your castle. I mean, that's as close as you get to, we better have a lot of reasons to be in your house and doing what we're doing. So we're recording, and there's departments that have the cameras. This conversation, and just, I always like to make this point too, this conversation is not because of Ferguson or New York. This conversation on body cams has taken place for several years now. I was in New Orleans 2 years ago, and it was a huge conversation. So a lot of people like to think that it just started. It's not. This has been an ongoing thing. The IACP has put out some guidelines on it. And I consider, no offense to the people in Madison, but I consider Madison to be more of a liberal city. And their department just released a report saying, slow down, time out. And I think if Madison, and if you read the report, it's a very well-done report, they make some of the same points I'm doing. You know, before you spend all this money, let's figure out where the laws are going. Let's see what it is. I don't think the majority of people want the interior of their home or them videotaped at their worst moment. And let me tell you, a domestic violence incident is some of the worst moment in a person's life, and then you can just come in and get that thing. Now, there's unintended consequences, too, and the Madison report points it out, of how everybody just wants this video. Brookfield, Wisconsin, has 80 cameras, and the chief, I just met with him a couple weeks ago, said that's the biggest unintended consequences is they are getting so many requests for the videos, they can't keep up the storage, and, you know, there's time frames. So,
like FOIA requests for that video?
For that video, and they're just requesting video that has nothing to do with them. They just want to see it, and they just want to, you know, somebody finds out that Troy McDonald was arrested. They just want the video because they know you, and then pretty quick, I have no control over what's on YouTube and not on YouTube. There's a lot of questions that really need to be answered before that becomes a reality. Again, the $775,000, that's up to the city council. I don't think it's the right time to do that. We have the in-car cameras. I think they work well. We have, I would say, a large majority of our officers would want the cameras. I'm sure there's some that don't. But it is, again, it only captures what's there. So if it doesn't work, it breaks because you're in a fight, I really highly doubt the headlines in the paper are going to be officer's camera broke during fight. It's going to be incident wasn't recorded because whatever facts they want. So I don't think we're there. I just, again, I think it's coming. You know, and I, again, not picking on the President of the United States, but pretty disingenuous of he's going to authorize 50,000 cameras. Thank you very much. But there's 700,000 law enforcement officers in the United States. That's, to me, those numbers don't add up. So, you know, if we're going to do this, it's a much bigger project. But again, let's work on the real issues. And the real issue, I think, is privacy at this point in time. And, you know, those need to be addressed for many reasons. You would know this as a younger man better than anybody else. With social media, once it's up there, you never
there
get it off.
Ever.
That's correct. Yeah. It's there forever, and you can't get it off.
Yeah. And, you know, you keep mentioning the media would take this and spin it. Do you feel as a department, and maybe not just the Kenosha Police, but, you know, as a part of the bigger police, that you're against the wall, that the media is misrepresenting what you do on a daily basis?
Well, I don't know that I would say on a daily basis. I do think, though, and I have been told by both locally and national media, which I've dealt with both, that in this day and age, in the social media with Twitter and Facebook and everything else, who breaks the story wins. That, I believe, now is the philosophy of the media. And I will probably say a name that you don't even remember, but when Walter Cronkite was on and then when I was growing up, it was a factual story. The facts were correct. It wasn't who broke that story first. It was who got the story correct. It was who got the information correct. It's not that way anymore. The media has a job to do. I appreciate that. And in a lot of cases, they are right there beside us getting the correct information out. But a couple of national stories you look at are the Boston bombing. How inaccurate was that initial information? The Ferguson. It was, they talked to people and they ran with the story. I don't care whether you believe or disbelieve the grand jury, but I did read through the majority of that stuff. A lot of them either changed their story or it wasn't there.
You mean the people who were interviewed for?
That's correct, yeah. For the media.
Yeah.
Their story didn't match when it came to the thing. And some people just like it. Hey, I'm going to get 15 seconds of fame and I'm going to be on this TV program. Again, I'm certainly beyond that. I'd prefer never to see be on the radio or TV or anywhere else. I understand that's not the way it is. But so I don't want to say that the media is totally against law enforcement or BECS, because, you know, recently we've had a couple of local incidents, and I've written a couple of opinions on it. They posted them, and I think they've done a great job. Once in a while, I'll get my laurel in the paper. I don't look for those things. So I don't want to say that the media of any type, you know, print or radio here, I think as you can see from this interview, I am not shy about answering your questions whatsoever. You may, when this interview is over, not appreciate any of my answers. But I'm not afraid to answer those questions, and I'm not afraid to attend groups and answer those questions. So as long as it's factual, I don't have a problem with it whatsoever.
And we're going to switch gears here and talk a little bit about another issue. And it was one of our most social posts ever on our Facebook page. And it dealt with the Pub 22 incident that we talked about at the top of the show. Hip-hop music was blaring. A dozen men, I think, were fighting. An officer was shoved into a police car. And that has led to the question of, is it the DJ's responsibility? Is it the people who should not be fighting to begin with? Is it their responsibility to control themselves? Is it the music? And so we'll bring you in, Sergeant John DeMario. What do you remember from that night?
Okay. I was not working that night, but I did get all the reports from the officers and their tavern summary. The reports stated that there was a large crowd, about 25 to 50 at first, and then they said it amassed to about 100 people. They were playing, a DJ was playing at Pub 22. And at approximately, I think it was like between 1 and 2, the crowd let out of the establishment, and there was ended up being a large fight outside. One person was knocked unconscious. Officer Tietrich and Officer Walters were first on scene, and they tried to get to the person to give him aid because they could clearly see he was injured. When they tried to get through the crowd, Officer Tietrich was assaulted by somebody. So they had to back out for their own safety. Eventually, other squads came to the scene and were able to assist, and they were able to get that the victim to the hospital to get some medical treatment.
Mm-hmm. And we have some comments again from you on social media. We have two here. Adrian Tanner says that this is ridiculous. For one, the DJ has nothing to do with what goes on outside of a bar. The music is not outside. Every time there is a black crowd, the police find a way to shut it down. Always. I've been to so many bars with white crowds that has had fights, but nothing happens to them or the club owners. It's not fair at all. This town is corrupt, period. So that's from Adrian Tanner. We also have one from Dwight Anderson, who says, it's the bar owner's fault for not controlling the type of music the DJ plays. I've worked as a bouncer, and hip-hop music always leads to a terrible crowd. So do you think that this music leads to this kind of behavior? Is it the music that riles them up?
I don't think it's the music that's at fault. I just think it's the people's moral character. I mean, you don't go to a tavern, and you go to a tavern to enjoy yourself and have a good time. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't go there to fight, to be disorderly and cause problems. And yes, it is the bar. It's partially the bar owner, because he's knowing that some of these venues of entertainment can cause problems. Yes, there are some entertainers that, you know, they have a following that they tend to become violent or out of control. And you also got to put responsibility on the patrons who are visiting that establishment, because at the end, they're the ones who are acting out of control. It doesn't matter what color you are. You know, it just matters on what type of person you are. Are you going to cause problems or not?
Mm-hmm. So if this was happening, yeah, go ahead.
I think, though, what we really need to make a note here, Troy, because, again, and I know we're headed to who's an issue here, but I do want to make this point so it's well known that, as you said, this was brought up in front of License and Permit and Pub 22, and I made the comment about DJs and the problem. I will tell you, and Sergeant DeMario can correct me right here, census, I am not aware of one fight we've had of this magnitude of any tavern since then. These individuals have not played here. So that in itself, over the last couple of months, has shown me that I'm on the right track here, that it is these individual DJs and the individuals that come there. It has nothing to do with the music. There are other taverns that play hip-hop. I go to D.C. a couple times a year, and there's one tavern I go into, which is a huge tavern. I guess I'd call it a club, two floors. It's 95% African-American. I happen to know the bartender there. They play hip-hop music. I have never, in probably 15 years now, seen an issue at this place. It's the individual character of the people that are there. You know, this tavern does not put up with any, you know, if you're out, you're out, and that's the end of it. They have a good working relationship with the police. You know, one of them had made a comment on this, too, that, well, these are all local people. Well, I remember the entire incident from Pub 22 reading the report. Nobody was from Kenosha. You know, these are individuals that are from mostly Illinois, but we get Racine. So they're coming, and they're causing problems in this city. To the question of whose responsibility it is, I guess I'm going to tell you it simply comes down to it's the bar owner's responsibility. They're the ones that hold the license, and they're the ones that risk losing that license. I could take the hard ball and just simply say, well, I'm going to ask that their license be revoked. I don't want to do that. I think that they get into this because of the money, and it's a tough world owning a bar right now, actually any small business. But, you know, that crowd, those DJs bring in a lot of money for that bar. But I look at it and say, well, you may have got a lot of money tonight, but if you lose your license, you no longer have your business. You know, and Sergeant DeMario and Inspector Lindquist met with the Tavern League yesterday to talk about some of the issues, and it's my understanding that that meeting went extremely well. Once it was explained of why things are there and, you know, communication, and that's certainly what you're trying to do with this show, is get the communication out there, is the biggest part. But I do think it is very important to make that note of, since that meeting until today, there has not been one of those issues, at least that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the chief is correct. There hasn't been any.
And see, the I know that the DJ spoke to the Kenosha News and said that he was losing money himself, that he was struggling to get other bookings. Do you feel a sense of responsibility, you know, for, you know, this kind of thing, or is that it's purely on him for dealing with that?
Oh, that's purely on him. I don't feel it's my responsibility to run his business no more than I do the bars. You know, we have the ordinance and laws that are passed to enforce. You know, it's not just the city of Kenosha Taverns where this individual has had issues. And again, we get from Lake County all the way up through Racine and perhaps more of where these have caused issues. So, in my opinion, it's certainly not my responsibility to help him find bookings or to cause him not to have bookings. Mm-hmm. You know, I never once said to any tavern, you can't book these DJs. That's up to them. But, you know, we get to the point of who loses their license.
Right, and it is the bar owner there. We also know that that there is the tavern, I think it's the Tavern Squad, that with the Kenosha Police Department, they go into different bars. Explain what those checks are like for people who haven't experienced them. When you go, explain what you do, John DeMario, Sergeant.
We have a second and a third shift tavern unit. We have a total of 14 tavern unit officers. It's not a full-time unit. It's a part-time unit, so they all go on different days.
So what percentage of the work day, I guess, is given to that?
Some days there won't be tavern squads out at all.
Oh, okay.
So it varies on what days we'll put them out there.
Okay.
Yeah, we usually go out about three times a week.
Okay.
And it's an eight-hour shift.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and there's two officers that do the deployments each time. So
they what kinds of things are you guys looking for when you go out?
I think this is a great point. He can maybe explain exactly how it works when we use our decoys, because that's one of the bigger things is there's a lot of misconception of what that means. But so maybe, John, if you go through how we get the decoys, not who they are by name, but what our purpose is and why we do this.
Okay. We do our normal compliance checks, and we also have a decoy program that we do. just your first question was our compliance checks. What we're looking for is underagers inside of taverns, make sure they're not loitering on premise, drinking alcohol. We check licenses, make sure there's a licensed bartender, make sure all their licenses are properly posted and accurate. And then we also talk to them, see if there's any needs that they need, if anything, you know, seen suspicious or anything that we could help them with. We also walk around and we talk to the patrons to see if they have any concerns, you know, and it's kind of like a community policing thing. For our decoy program, is what we do is we get students from Carthage, Parkside, or Gateway, sometimes Academy. It's a voluntary program, and what they do is they go into establishments, grocery stores, gas stations, and taverns, to see if all these business owners are compliant with all the state and local laws. So what we'll do is we'll have two officers there in plain clothes, and they will be with one or two decoys, and they'll send them into establishment with for them trying to purchase alcohol or tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in the taverns also, and then they would, if we do it at the taverns, there's an undercover officer with them just for their protection. But when we do this, we talk to the decoy in detail. You know, they are not allowed to deceive or in any way or try to trick the customer, because our goal is for the establishment not to sell, not to go there and get a ticket. That's not what we want, because then we're not doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
And then that means they're not following the law. So when they go inside, if they get denied a purchase, they come out, tell the tavern unit, we mark it down, we go to the next establishment. If our decoy would go inside and purchase alcohol or tobacco, they would come out, turn it over to our tavern unit, and then they would go inside and, you know, talk to the clerk, get the licensee or the owner, and they would issue the appropriate citations.
I think a good point, though, here that I just want to make, too, is, as John said, there's no point to deceive here. The individuals that are going in are using their real valid IDs. We don't give them fake IDs. So it is whoever that is. So it's their real picture, their real information. So there's no attempt by us to put a picture of a 30-year-old on a 19-year-old driver's license. I mean, you know, I think some people believe that this is their real driver's license, and we've had people keep their real driver's license because, as John knows, if the taverns get people that present fake IDs, they can take them and keep them, and they turn them over to the tavern. So we've actually had to go into establishments and say we need that ID back because it's one of our decoys, which, you know, is there too. So there is no deception there. It is really, truly to make sure they're following that, and there's 147, 153, whatever the number is, of licensed establishment, and less than 5% of those ever cause any issues. I mean, I bet if I went down the list of taverns in this city with you, you probably never heard of some of them because we just don't have any issues at them. And I would say that, again, 95%+ of all the taverns are compliant. They don't cause us any issues. They follow the rules. You know, they buy the liquor where they're supposed to. Again, we don't have any issues. We meet with them whenever they want to. Again, yesterday there was a meeting, and my understanding, it went very well. They now understand. But part of it was this deception with the decoy. And, again, it's just our way of checking to make sure they're following it. It's too late when it's a car accident and a fatality and we have to backtrack and say, well, that 20-year-old, you know, was at this tavern and drank, or that 20-year-old was at this grocery store and bought that alcohol that he served or drank and stuff. You know, that's a little late to be following the rules and writing tickets then. So it's more of a proactive. We've started this year sending letters to those that don't sell. John will sign the letter. I'll personally sign the letter. We send it to him, and we say thank you for, you know, on such and such a date, we had a decoy in there, and you followed your rules. Thank you very much.
Hmm. I was in prep work for this episode, and I was telling a story to my boss, and he thought I should bring it to you. Back in the 70s, my mother used to own a liquor wholesale company, and one of her biggest business towns was Kenosha during that time. And just how the transformation, as you say, there are still a lot of bars, and people say that there's a bar on every corner in Kenosha. but how much different it is from back then and how much work has gone into cleaning up the area because there were a lot of other seedy businesses, you know, at that time.
Well, I wasn't here in the 70s, but it certainly has changed just in the 80s when I started here and stuff. The city has done a remarkable job of changing the face of, you know, Kenosha from being Sin City, if you will, for the bars and stuff. But it was a different time. It was a different era. You know, there was a lot more factory work and a whole different thing. So I think the cities, and particularly, you know, Mayor Antaramian and Mayor Bosman have done a great job of having a different vision for what the city needs to look like. But I personally think the corner bars are part of the cornerstone of a community. I mean, if I go, again, and I go to D.C. a few times a year and stuff, I'd love to go to the little corner bars if you're just going to go in, because that's really the heart and soul of there. You know, you can go to the big name clubs or whatever. That's to me, that's not fun, you know, going into some of the little bars. And I don't personally go to any of the bars here in Kenosha for several reasons, and most of it is I don't want to sit and listen to somebody complain about a parking ticket that they got that I really don't have any clue about, you know.
And that's a good question. You know, how do you have fun? How does the chief have fun in a city that knows you and is, you know, doesn't want, like you said, to talk, they'll talk to you about tickets or whatever's going on in their life?
You know, I guess I'm certainly older now, and I don't drink much alcohol whatsoever, no matter where I'm at anymore. If I have one or two drinks a year anymore, that's a lot. But, you know, so I do go to a lot of the restaurants in town here, and I try to vary all of those restaurants in different styles. But, you know, as I think any chief, though, and this isn't just me, of any city, it's tough to go out into those. And believe me, the Tavern Squad, Tavern League, I should say, has asked me many times, hey, why don't you stop in and do this? And, again, special events maybe once in a while, and there are, you know, restaurants that have bars and stuff in them. But there's a lot to, you know, I don't want to listen to somebody talk about a parking ticket. You know, at my level, I just don't know about that. But there's also the perception that, you know, I saw the chief sitting at the bar, and he had a cocktail, and then he drove and whatever. It's just not worth it to me there. So I guess at this point, just being at my age, I have more fun sitting on my couch with my golden retriever, and we watch TV. So, but it is not only for me, but, you know, for the officers, too, and especially the guys that work the taverns. You know, they're in there. But I will tell you my perception, and again, might be different from those there, is the Tavern Squad members really have tried to form a relationship with the bar owners, and I think the majority of them they have. I've attended several license and permit meetings, and I don't see an animosity there. You'll get the occasional incident, mm-hmm. you know, such as Pub 22 here. But I really personally don't see the animosity. Maybe your statistics and whoever writes in are different than that, but, you know, I'm not, as the chief, I'm not getting these complaints in my office. I'm just not.
And do you feel like that is noise in a way? Do you feel like it's just noise, or do you think that some of their concern is valid?
Well, I think it's always valid, no matter what it is, whether I agree or disagree with it. To that person, it's a valid concern. While it may not be a concern to me, and this is just police in general, not necessarily the taverns. You know, we see everything from homicides to eggs thrown on a car. Those certainly have different severities to them, but to the person that had the eggs thrown on their car, that's an issue to them. I mean, you know, it may not rise to much of a level to me because I've seen so much, but no, it's an absolute. So to everybody that has their opinions, they're there. I can't change those opinions.
We couldn't fit everything we wanted to in this broadcast. The time was just rolling and rolling, and so I said, you know what, let's make a special Part 2 edition available online. So here's what you can do. Visit WGTD.org and go to the Community Matters Archive, and there you will see Part 1 and as well as the Part 2 of the things we could not include here this morning, including a question I asked, what would he do if he was asked to fire Darren Wilson, the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown. Would he fire him if he was faced with that choice? That and so much more on the part two on WGTD.org. Thank you so much for listening this Saturday morning on Community Matters. For WGTD, I'm Troy McDonald.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public.